I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening in Nova Scotia at Axe Radio Canada, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And today we are speaking with Karen Mazin Miller. She was on the show apparently 4 years ago, she said today. I remember speaking to her, but I didn't realize it had been that long. And she was on speaking about her previous book, Hand Wash Cold. Well, she's written a new one, Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. And Karen Mazin Miller is a Zen Buddhist priest and teacher at the Hazy Moon Zen Center in Los Angeles, California. And she's also the author of Hand Wash Cold and Mama Zen. And she leads retreats around the country. She's here to speak with us today about what she learned from her Zen garden, about her book Paradise in Plain Sight, and just to chat with us. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Thank you, Marie.
Thanks for being with me.
I remember everything like it's yesterday, so it seems like we just finished one conversation and here we are going to start another.
Well, I'm excited to have you back on the show. Thank you. And I remember, I should have actually listened to the show again because it has been that so long. I remember having a great conversation with you and feeling totally uplifted by it, so I'm so glad to have you back.
Well, let's see if we can make lightning strike twice.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about what is Paradise in Plain Sight? Why did you read it and why should listeners
read it?
Why did you write it and why should listeners read it?
You know, I need to read it too, to tell you the truth. My husband, my family and I live in a little house in Southern California that just happens to have Southern California's oldest private Japanese garden as our backyard. It's a very large garden, relatively speaking, much larger than our home. And I have lived here now for about 17 years. And I came to this place quite unexpectedly, like we often arrive at some place along our journey. In fact, we always arrive at places we don't expect to along our journey, and felt quite an affinity, talk about synchronicity, felt intuitively and instinctually that this was where I was meant to come and where we would live. We subsequently started a family, and now we live in this place in a suburb of Los Angeles called Sierra Madre, which is quite an ordinary little place, an ordinary street, quite unremarkable house that we have hidden behind our little bungalow, this exquisite jewel of a garden that was built in 1916 and has quite a bit of lore, a marvelous history behind it. But for my purposes, what it represents is a place to practice, a place to actually deal in a physical way, in a real way, with doing things that I don't know how to do, keeping my eyes open, and letting nature in this case, or the garden in this case, be my teacher. So I was casting about and really considering what I should write about next, and a very good friend, you know, we have a lot of friends, we all have a lot of friends, but the good friends that we have are the ones who point us in a direction that perhaps we'd overlooked. And someone said, why don't you write about your garden? And so I essentially am letting the garden speak for itself and finding kind of the universal, timeless wisdom lessons that are taught by the ground beneath our feet.
Beautifully said. Well, Karen, you talk a lot about the way, and in Zen, they do talk about the way. And so what is the way? Can you define it for us?
Yeah, the way is the way we live. And in Zen, we practice the way we live. And that way is to be present, awake and aware. It's the essence of Buddhism, the essence of more than Buddhism, or maybe less than Buddhism. It is precisely what Buddha did and taught, to be awake and aware in each moment of our lives, which is quite simple, but very difficult. And in the tradition that I practice, perhaps all spiritual traditions are called paths, but in my spiritual tradition, the path is called the way. And the transformative moment in a personal journey is when you realize that you don't have to find a path, that you don't have to look for a way, that the way is your life and you're already on the path, you're already in your life. And simply to see it no longer as being separate and apart from you, then you can begin to truly live in an intimate way with your own life and engage in what appears in front of you without imposing distance or resistance. The kinds of way of thinking, the ways of thinking that we bring to our life that make us feel alienated, isolated, in despair, and that we are adrift and lost and nowhere near what we might presume to be paradise.
Hmm. Now, you have a definition of paradise that you've looked more deeply into, because paradise to us, a lot of people, when we think of paradise, we think of Hawaii or we think of heaven or living in a palace. What is paradise?
Right. We have come to think of the word paradise as being some unattainable ideal, some perfection. And typically what we think of it is as Eden, you know, life after death. And, you know, the closest we can approximate to that might well be Maui, you know. It may be some place we can visit if we're lucky one time a year or maybe once in our lives. And so just by then, by definition, if paradise is some place we aren't, then where we are is much less, you know, is not nice, is not where we want to be, is not perfect. So how I came by this understanding, it's not my own definition of paradise, it's the original definition of the word paradise. And I write in the book that when my husband and I first moved to a place that happened to have, you know, Southern California's oldest private Japanese garden, a 7,500 square foot garden, you know, with ponds and plants and bridges and waterfalls and a tea house and all these things that were screaming out to us that we were not fit for the task of caring for it. I read a lot of books. This is what we do whenever we find ourselves in a situation that we feel unprepared for, right? We go to the book, you know, we go to the expert, we get advice. And I was reading one book which was about the history of Japanese gardens. And the history of gardens, actually all gardens, originated in Persia, old Persia. And there the word was created, paradise. And it was a word that they gave to a ground that was often part of a royal compound, you know, so people of extraordinary wealth and status cultivated gardens, and they might be originally take the form of menageries or sporting grounds, but paradise, the word that was given to them, actually means an enclosed area. Just that, it just means an enclosed area, because the two parts of the word that were brought together to create the word paradise mean a walled enclosure or walled area. So this was just something, just like us, our backyards, or maybe our patios or our balconies, a defined space within which we cultivate fruit, you know, or plants or pleasure, you know, green, flowers. So these were called a paradise. And then that word came to be used in creation stories, and one of the creation stories was Eden. And then by virtue of all of that, nowadays we associate it with something that is imaginary, something that's not real, something that's not on this earth, or that's not where we are. So that's the kind of change that we have to make, not being confused by how we define words, really looking through that until we can see that paradise can never be any place other than where we are. And if we can begin to view it as a place of beauty where we can cultivate an appreciation for it, then it truly changes everything.
Hmm. Karen, now, when you talk about the way, thank you for that definition of paradise, and I feel like so many of us, we, just the same way you came to Zen Buddhism, you were on a search, you felt like things were missing in your life, like you were lost. And what is the difference between the way and just dealing with what comes up in your life and having no direction or lacking ambition? I mean, so many of us, we feel like if we don't have a plan, then we're not on the right path.
Well, you're actually asking about the difference between living in a deluded way, a confused way, an over-reliance, and which is always going to be disappointing, on our egocentric mind, the plan, the thought, you know. And when we do that, we feel we're inherently rejecting things as they are. We're inherently rejecting life itself in favor of our ideas about how our life is supposed to go. When we dwell in our own ideas about what makes a good life, or what we are supposed to do, or what the plan is, or what's going to happen 5 years down the road, we instantly remove ourselves from the immediacy and spontaneity of life itself. We are continuously exiling ourselves from our lives by virtue of, futuristic thinking about where do I want to go. And, you know, there's really nothing wrong with that. That's how we all live, except if you've lived enough to know that things don't really ever go, no matter how much aspiration, no matter how much ambition we have. Even when we get to some place that we think is our happy place, we're not happy for long. It doesn't satisfy or fulfill. You know, so only when we truly admit we're lost and not like, I'm looking for someplace better, how do I get to someplace better? When we truly can surrender that I can't, my ideas don't work. That's complete surrender. My ideas about what I want, what I need, you know, what's wrong, that those don't work, then you have hope of really being able to see what's right in front of you instead of rejecting what's right in front of you. That's the difference.
Mm. You talk in the book about your father, the example of how he was always moving and always looking for this happier place and never really was content. Can you share that with us?
Sure. And I also write in the book that I don't in any way consider my father's life or his behavior or, this pattern that he had of being any different than how the rest of us live. But I start by talking about how when we were young, you know, my father was always planning the trips that we would take, and was really enthusiastic and engaged before we left on the trip, you know, mapping the routes and packing the car and, you know, plotting the trip and marking the maps and all of those things. And so we would always set out early on road trips and arrive someplace where, to my observation, as soon as we got there, he was ready to leave. As soon as we got anywhere, he was ready to leave. He could never settle. He could never enjoy. His mind, he had the habit of mind, which was solely focused on the escape, the departure, the leaving, the next. Does that sound familiar? What's next? Where to? You know, so there was this, you could feel this agitation and this discomfort in him. And it's no different than the rest of us. You know, we if we're not careful, we're going to practice that way of thinking and that way of living. As soon as we acquire something, it's going to begin to disappoint us. You see? You know, the relationship will, we'll think it is failing us. The job will begin to bore us. You know, we begin to despise that which is familiar. It all comes from that same root cause. I do not know how to be satisfied with where I am. And, you know, if we practice it, it really overtakes us and becomes a really haunting and debilitating affliction. We can't enjoy anything. We can't enjoy other people's company. We can't enjoy the sun. We can't enjoy the rain. We can't enjoy the winter. We can't enjoy the summer. You see, it's just a constant restless motion. That's ego-driven. You know, that ego being, I need, I want, I think, I know. And we're torturing ourselves, and then we also, you know, torment those who we live with, because we can't ever come to rest. We can't ever come to rest. Now, don't be afraid, because, you know, in this line of thinking, to someone who has a very agitated and active mind who is afraid to come to rest, the thinking goes, well, then nothing happens. How will I get anywhere? You see, how can I, you know, you're asking me just to freeze myself in motion, and absolutely not, because life is in constant motion. It's continuously, spontaneously appearing and disappearing. There's no such thing as the status quo. But you know in your heart if you can be satisfied. You know in your heart if you're calm and if you can come to rest, because then you can accept not just yourself and your circumstance, but everybody in the world, and they know when they have your acceptance. So it changes the world completely.
Okay, so now from my thinking mind, I'm like, I'm not satisfied. How do I get to that state?
Practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, when I prescribe in this book, it's not about changing the way you think. You have to physically practice. And it's so interesting that the practice of Zazen, Zen meditation, which is my practice, is the practice of sitting still in one place. Is it comfortable? No. Is it likable at first? No, it's miserable. Why? Because we are conditioned, we've conditioned our bodies and our minds to only, to be addicted to that motion. And we do it in everything. It's not just our physical mobility. The real problem is the overactive mind, the mind that is addicted to stimulation. We stimulate ourselves through our electronic devices. It used to just be TV, or through our, you know, what we eat, you know, whatever our compulsive, repetitive habits. Those are simply feeding our sickness. You know, so we practice standing still. Practice sitting still. You know, and when you keep your eyes open, you're not asleep or daydreaming, you see that everything still happens, you know. The sun still moves across the sky, the wind still blows, the birds sing, the grass grows. You know, it's constant, dynamic. Life is not, you know, ever at a standstill. But you have to be still in order to see that. If it were just a matter of reading about it or thinking about it, we would all be perfectly happy. We'd all be enlightened.
At least everyone who listens to this show, that's for sure, yeah. Well, Karen, so it sounds like you're saying that when you meditate, you sit with your eyes open.
Absolutely. Zen meditation, we sit with our eyes open, not wide open like, okay, let me just move across, you know, the field of vision in front of me and just, you know, kind of entertain myself. No, we keep the eyes open because we're practicing waking up. And we sit in exactly the same form and according to the same instructions as Buddha. Buddha didn't close his eyes, have somebody tell him a fairy tale, and imagine being someplace else. You know, the practice of Zen is the practice of being present. Where, there's only one place ever that you can be present. It's called the here and now. So when we close our eyes, we drift into fantasy or daydream, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what we do? Conjure up something else? We have enough practice at that. Mm-hmm. So we have to practice something else. So sometimes for people, just the practice of keeping your eyes slightly open, looking at a spot on the floor or the wall in front of you, about 2.5 feet in front of you, and letting the gaze come to rest. Letting the gaze come to rest. That's a critical thing. You're not looking or seeking stimulation, entertainment, what's new, what's different. Practice that. That's why it's so difficult. It's like, can I just sit here for 5 minutes? Can I sit here for 10 minutes? You know, we tell ourselves we don't have the time, which, of course, is hilarious. We just don't have the willpower, you know, the discipline. We're not quite yet sick of the sickness of the restless, agitated, unsatisfied mind.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Karen. Well, it's time for a break now, so we will be back with more synchronicity in just a moment. Right now, we are speaking with Karen Mazin Miller. She is the author of Mama Zen and Hand Wash Cold, but right now we're speaking about her latest book, Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. And you can find her at KarenMazinMiller.com, and you can also find me at spiritualshow.com. We will be back in just a moment with more synchronicity.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
This is how to make a great sandwich. Step 1. Get the soft but sturdy bread.
Up in smoke, it's where my money goes.
Step number 2. Butter it with your favorite spreads. Step 3. Put in the meats and veggies. Step 4. Shake it up. Pepper, salt, and all.
It's 11 p.m. Check out sneak out. Open fridge and I drink daddy big styles. Multi refine girl, more can reach out. And I'm NTA, more can speak out.
Step 5. Find another piece of sturdy bread. And that, my friends, is how you make a great sandwich. For more, listen to Soul Sandwich every Monday from 5 to 6 on CITR 101.9.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're speaking right now with Karen Mazin Miller, the author of Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you about this, I believe it's Ango. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it. Ongo, peaceful dwelling for 3 months. What is that?
In a formal Zen center, many of them that practice in the monastic tradition, which is the tradition that I practice in. And let me just make clear, when Zen Buddhism came to America or was brought to America at the mid-20th century or so, it had been in Japan primarily a monastic tradition. In other words, monks or priests only practiced in Zen temples. And there wasn't necessarily a way for the laity or lay people to practice. And almost all of the teachers who came from Japan in the 20th century wanted to change that and make the practice open and available for everyone, understanding that everyone benefits from a meditation practice or a practice of Zazen, which is Zen meditation. There's absolutely nothing that in the form of requirements or prerequisites for you to be able to engage in a contemplative practice. But at the same time, the form or the template that we practice with, in most cases, is unchanged. So, and carried forward from the time of the Buddha. And Ongo is an intensive practice period. Oftentimes, on a practice calendar at a Zen center or a Zen monastery, and it replicates a time that was observed during the age of the Buddha, when Buddha and all of his disciples were itinerants. You know, they just moved from place to place, and they really did not have a permanent place of practice except in the rainy seasons. And in the rainy seasons, it became feasible and practical that they all needed to gather in a place where there was shelter, and so it was a single place of practice. And their time together was called an ongo, which means peaceful dwelling. And so still now, in contemporary American Zen centers and Canadian Zen centers, there's going to be a practice time, typically, that's called ongo. It may be 3 months or 2 months, or sometimes it's 1 month. But during that time, the schedule of practice intensifies, and more sitting is done, more time on the cushion is offered, and a single priest or trainee may be named as a head trainee and stay at the temple or the Zen center continuously during that time and create a strong practice environment for everyone to join in.
Thanks, Karen. Now, you mentioned wanting to change things so that people who weren't priests and monks could come in and practice this. But so isn't the act of wanting to change not Zen? Like, I'm a little bit confused because it, on the one hand, while reading your book, it seems like accepting what is and working with what you have in front of you. And then at the same time, there's still mention of wanting to change. So what's the difference?
Well, change is always in front of us. So adaptation occurs. And the reason that adaptation occurs is because it suits what appears in front of us. So in other words, to come from one country to the other, and if you look at all, things are changing all the time, depending upon the culture or the place that you're inhabiting. And in America, for instance, when teachers came, it wasn't to replicate the past. It was to take what is unchanged is the practice, not the form. What's unchanged is the essence of the practice, you see. So it just means you don't have to be a priest in order to participate in Ongo. You don't have to be a renunciate in order to have a contemplative practice. So actually the two are quite compatible. And therein lies really the secret to transcending our delusion and our dualistic thinking. Our ego mind categorizes and defines things in terms of opposites. There's either change or no change. There's either right or wrong. There's either this or that. But you see, the correct Buddhist view is that life is both changing and unchanging. There is an unchanging aspect, and then there is a changing aspect. And to transcend that duality, you see it all the time in life itself. Do you see that? I mean, can you see that? Things are changing. Do you ever have the sense that nothing ever changes around here? And yet if you keep your eyes open, you see that everything is always changing around here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But to be in the moment itself is transitory, and it's spontaneous. So the only place there's disagreement or argument or misunderstanding is in your head. Otherwise, this is how the world itself operates.
Mm-hmm.
Some things you seem like, oh my goodness, you know, the orbits haven't changed, you know, the sun is still in the sky. But every day is different. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You have to step outside of your head in order to see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the challenge, because there's that, like, you said, you know, you have to admit my ideas don't work.
Yeah, nobody's ideas work.
Yeah.
It's not about changing one set of ideas for the other. It's about dropping that so that you clear. That's why you have clarity. You only have wisdom only surfaces in the absence of the delusion that we call the thinking mind. Now, does that mean we never think again? Absolutely not. We just don't fabricate theory and philosophy out of a set of ideas. We wake up. That's what Buddhism is, waking up. Buddhism is not a philosophy. It's not a code of ethics. You know, it's not scripture. It's practice. So let that be your guidepost. Seek Buddhist teaching from practitioners, not philosophers. Or you'll just end up loading yourself up with lots and lots of ideas that will not help you when you need help, when the time gets tough, when you get old and you get sick, or when loved ones die, or you near your death. And that was the impetus for Buddha's, spiritual quest. That we all get old, we all get sick, and we all die. Real stuff. Yeah. So ideas don't work in those times and spaces. They don't work there. We have to have something that's more direct. How do we face difficulty? How do we deal with loss? How do we? Not an aphorism. Or not an idea, the reality of it. And so your spiritual path and your spiritual practice has to involve your body, your butt, and your head. Not just your head.
So what's the difference, Karen? And now, as soon as I say difference, I'm thinking about how you were talking about duality.
Okay. We have differentiation and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
We can see there is difference, you see, but we just don't attach to that in terms of that being an explanation or an answer or reality, you see. Some things are tall and some things are short,
mm-hmm.
you see. That's really true. But go ahead and ask your question.
Well, you said, you know, how do we deal with these things? And the thing is that we do deal with these things. I mean, right now my apartment has been flooded for the last week and my landlord went MIA. With no emergency number. So I've been dealing with that.
Of course you do. Now, so the question is, yeah, we have to go through it no matter what.
Yeah.
We have to go through difficulty no matter what. Yeah, and all of us do, because things get flooded and they break. And, you know, stuff happens all the time. So it's not a matter of avoiding it. If I practice, I'm going to avoid difficulty. Absolutely not. But you see, to some people, and maybe to people who are less, practice than you are, it can be earth-shattering. It can be, you know, it can be horrific. So the question is not, how do I avoid, you know, circumnavigate? How do I get out of trouble? No, the question is, how do I move through it? And we want to move through it. Once we've moved through it enough of it to realize maybe that we know it's going to come, actually, it's happening all the time. We know it's going to come. How can I survive that? Because it feels like it's going to kill us, you see? Or it feels like we break down. Or, you know, that we can't function. So that's really what we're talking about. And in our heart of hearts, we don't do this prescriptively, like, okay, what do I need to do in order to improve myself or even to improve my life? A spiritual practice is not prescriptive in that way. Pills are prescriptive. No, a spiritual practice says, I've woken up to the fact that my life is going to be full of trouble. And it's not going to get better. Because if I really look at what's ahead of me is I'm going to get old, you know, and stuff is going to happen. And it's not going to suit my fancy. It's not always the ice cream melts, you see. And that's what then leads us. And what is calling us is not some book on a shelf or some teacher on a TV screen. You know, what's calling to us is we have to have it a sense of a deeper knowing that there has to be more than this. There has to be more than just a life of endless pain and suffering. That's what calls to us.
And that's the thing. Like I have with this situation, I'm actually handling it really well. Everyone's amazed how calm I am, and I'm kind of like, well, I guess I'm being kind of zen about it because I'm like, well, it is what it is. I have no control over when she comes back to town and how she's going to deal with this, which I imagine she's probably going to freak out. And so part of me is sort of dreading dealing with her. But at the same time, I just keep reminding myself, okay, it is what it is. I just have to do my best to contain the situation as much as possible. But I mean, what? Yeah, it's just sort of... The feeling that there has to be more. I mean, I feel like that's almost where the pain comes from because...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. Desire. And it's not necessarily the desire that's a problem. We all want good things, you see? It's the attachment to desire. It's the notion that it's only going to be okay if I get what I want, when I want it, you see? And it may not be in... You know, I may not be talking about you, but don't you know people? Can't you picture people? Haven't you? Who, again, going back to my father, it's only going to be okay if I get to the next place. It's only going to be okay. In the meantime, how much harm is hurt is done out of his discomfort, his inability to accept wherever we are at the time for the time being, however it is for the time being. Here's your promise. Nothing is permanent. Now, that's also the curse. It's the blessing and the curse. If you have a toothache, here's the blessing. Nothing is permanent, you see. If you love your child the way they are today, if you had a good day, you know, if you feel like you're on top of the world, here's the curse. Nothing is permanent. So, you see, this is like somebody once said, you know, it's really just about the waves are going to keep coming, but, you know, learn to swim. The waves are going to keep coming, but learn to surf. You know, it doesn't mean that it's not changing. It means that you are relating to that change in a different way. And it doesn't mean you don't ever get angry or frustrated. It means that perhaps you are not responding in a same harmful way to that. And what you're simply practicing when you're practicing is not you're waiting for some kind of pie-in-the-sky event to occur. You are experiencing your own displeasure. You're experiencing your own fear. You're experiencing your own impatience. You're experiencing your own discomfort. That's what happens in a sitting practice. And you see that you can move through it and beyond it without causing a catastrophe. I hope that helps. That's really all I have to offer.
Yeah, it's...
It's not high-minded stuff, Marie. Yeah. It's not high-minded. It's not hard. It's not hard to explain, but it's very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's so plain and simple and obvious. You can't think your way around it. You can't think your way around anything. And for you, and certainly for me in my life, that was the big problem. I'm a very fast, clever, smart thinker. But you can't outsmart your life, you see? Stuff happens, whether it was on the plan or not. You see, you need something far. You need wisdom in order to be able to grapple with the reality of life. Your thoughts, your plan, your scheme, your knowledge is useless.
But then it brings me back to, then how do you change things for the better? Because
they change by themselves.
Yeah.
They change by themselves. But again, you keep a, what I hear you saying, do you have a practice?
Me?
You have to have a practice.
I do.
And that practice has to be on the ground, and that practice has to be grounded, and it has to be something that you do every day. What you're doing is replacing a negative habit of mind and body with a positive habit of mind and body. And in terms of time, you know, we have been practicing doing things in this familiar way forever. In other words, I've been practicing my fear. I've been practicing my doubt. I've been practicing my greed. I've been practicing my anger forever. So it's important that we understand that although practice delivers an immediate benefit, we're going to be practicing forever. We have to practice forever. You know, because if what we're really seeking is resolution and peace and calm, and even to say happiness is missing the point. To seek truth, we're going to practice forever, so we better start now. But we can start small. And one moment of undistracted awareness, one moment where we're not judging, comparing, resisting, where we're not speaking or acting out of anger or greed or ignorance, it has positive impact forever. Have you ever tossed a pebble into a pond?
Mm-hmm.
You see, that radiating motion goes on and on and on. That's how and why we do it. Because it makes a difference, and it makes a difference forever.
Mm. Okay.
I know. You don't buy it, I can tell.
No,
but that's because you're trying to think it through.
Yeah. No, I definitely, in reading your book, there were moments of like calm and I was like, yeah. And then there were moments where I was almost in tears because it's just like, I remember as a kid, people would tell me, because I lived in foster care, people would tell me, it'll get better, it'll get better. It doesn't get better.
Oh, it doesn't get better there. No, you have to make, that's your call to action. Nobody makes it better for you. You have to make it better. How? Well, I think I prescribed a path. But it does involve no longer seeking or searching or waiting for or wondering. It involves the noble and some would even say the humbling act of surrendering to where you are right now. But this is something that will come to you like this phone call comes to you. You no longer need to engage in self-improvement. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing lacking. There's nothing missing. Wouldn't you like to be able to know that for yourself? Yeah. It's a relief. Genuinely, it's a relief. And there's nothing New Age about this. You know, there's nothing New Age about it. So until you can sit down and cultivate that faith in yourself and faith in your life as it is, then you can get up and move forward, taking that confidence wherever you go, transforming the place that you live. How? With nothing other than your non-distracted attention and awareness. Receiving your life. Receiving life. You know? And then you don't even have to engage in questions of whether it's better or worse. That's irrelevant. Whether it's night or day, you know, north or south. It's just you in your universe. How are you going to experience it this time around? That's the question for you. It's a question for all of us. And I hope this time together, well, I know this much. In this time together with you, Marie, I have not caused anyone any harm. And that, for me, means my practice today is working.
Can you say more about that?
Sure. If I don't practice, in other words, if I can't sit and practice watching how my self-centered fears and thoughts arise and how they contaminate and poison the world I inhabit, if I don't, sitting down and saying nothing, first off, spares everyone else from my negative comments. It's maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 12 minutes that I'm not throwing something, you see. I'm not speaking in an unkind way. I'm not bothering anyone. I'm not judging anyone. And now, if I can do that with myself, too, if I can just sit and let my mind go still and calm and rest, let thoughts come up and disappear as they do by themselves, keep my eyes open so I don't engage in a waste of time, which is fantasy or daydream, or even reliving the past, you see, as though I can change it, or fast-forwarding into the future as though I can prevent some future, you know, event from occurring. If I can just stay right here, that's called peace. And actually, it's always present. I get to enter into it. And then, having injured no one, you know, created no drama or dilemma, manufactured no confusion or doubt. See, that's called good. I've done good. And I call it a good day.
Thanks, Karen. I wanted to ask you, I'm actually moving the show away from spirituality towards the subject of happiness. I want to focus on practical methods of maintaining balance and happiness, like through psychology and meditation and things like that, rather than having psychics on the show and talking so much about the law of attraction and whatnot. And I'm just wondering, as from a Zen Buddhist perspective, what advice or what words do you have for me making this change?
Well, I'd say that, you know, in a way they're part and parcel of the same thing you just said. What practical things? And you know, from my background, Zen Buddhism is the most practical application of, you know, both psychological theory, you know, and Buddhist philosophy. It basically all comes down to you and how you experience your life. It doesn't come down to the external, you see. And so, yes, meditation, and I think people have written books about this too. They've done a little bit of meditation, whether it was secular or not, and I know that most people tend to be more drawn to the secular practice of mindfulness because they don't want to get involved in the mumbo-jumbo of Buddhism or something else, which is just another source of fear. But yeah, sitting still and quiet, you know, for a length of time a day can change the habit of judgment, comparison, assessment. That's what creates the feeling of lack. Is we tell ourselves we're lacking. We tell ourselves what we don't have. We tell ourselves we're inadequate. We tell ourselves we need more, you see. And my first teacher say, whatever you think, you not only do you create, but you believe. I mean, we believe what we tell ourselves. We believe that more than what anybody else tells us, right? So just stopping that habit of dwelling in the negative judgment, the critical mind, makes a huge difference. And then my own teacher here most recently has suggested to others that really what my practice is, what Buddha taught, all of them are positive affirmations. All of them are positive affirmations. We may not want to think about that or call them that, but in fact, all of Buddha's teachings are positive affirmations. He's continually telling you to go toward the away from self-service, self-criticism, self-limitation, away from that kind of thinking and more into the universal, the service to others, you know, the bigger world. And so, positive affirmations. I release all fear. I release all judgment. I love myself. I love. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. You see, we see these things, and you might say in our critical mind, which may be something like me that you have cultivated, you might say, how can that work? I don't know how it works, but it does. If you consider that every moment of our lives is just a moment, if I say, I release all fear, that takes care of it. In that moment, I've released all fear. Why? By simply taking the vow. It's a vow. I've testified. I've articulated it. I've manifested it right there. So that's one way. I recommend seated meditation. I've become it's like a one-note song now. If a Zen Buddhist priest and teacher won't tell people that the practice works, then that's not a very good Zen teacher or priest. The practice works. The practice works. And if it doesn't work for you, try something else. That's what the Buddha said. That's what the Buddha taught.
All right, thank you. Well, we just have a few minutes left in the show, Karen. I did want to ask you, and I think you've kind of answered this, but I'm still sort of picking it apart. I hope I'm not driving you crazy.
Well, if you were driving me crazy, I wouldn't be a very good practitioner either.
I guess that's a good point.
My fear is that you're driving yourself crazy, which you can put an end to.
All right. That's probably pretty accurate. So in the on page 87...
Which I don't know what's on page 87.
There's the evening gatha. There's a quote that says that opportunity is lost, like time moves. Opportunity is lost. Take heed. Do not squander your life. Yeah. And earlier in the book, you talked about settling for what is. Well, isn't settling squandering our lives?
You see, you're dealing in a different definition of settle. I'm talking about coming to rest where you stand now. See, and you're, again, presuming here that if I stand still, the world stands still. My life stops. The first thing that I want you to see is nothing could be further from the truth. Just by virtue of you, and I mean literally, you cannot stop your life. You cannot stop time. You cannot stop anything. But you have to be still. You have to still the thinking mind. Try to stop thinking about it. And then you'll see. Right now, a leaf is falling, you see? Is that static? Is that going nowhere? Absolutely not. Things are appearing and disappearing continuously. What we want to stop is that what's really nonstop about our lives is this rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat, what if, what about, that's actually insanity. So don't dwell there. Actually, it's almost a paradox. Once you can surrender your control, which is a false, it's an illusion, your notion that you're controlling, driving the outcome, you know, once you can relinquish that and step back, actually, the universe, like I say, rises to meet the soles of your feet, and you will find exactly what you need when you need it. It just may not be your idea of what you needed. But it's exactly there for you. You know, life is good. It sustains itself. It serves itself. You know, carrying forward your fear that says, I have to shape it, define it, name it, I have to list it, I have to go get it. That's a recipe for despair.
Hmm. Well, Karen, we have just a few minutes left in the show, and I'm wondering, while you think on what you'd like to leave us with, we're speaking with Karen Mazin Miller. She's the author of Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Her website is Karen Mazin Miller, KarenMazinMiller.com, KarenMazinMiller.com, Paradise in Plain Sight. Karen, what would you like to leave us with before we wrap up the show today?
Well, of course, I encourage people to come and see the garden. And in one sense, I mean the garden that's in my backyard. Everybody's welcome to come to Southern California if you should ever find yourself here. And get in touch with me and say, can I come see this garden? Absolutely, yes, because like the rest of your life, it's been waiting for you to see it. Okay. And this garden has been waiting 100 years. So you can come and see that garden. And the other thing is to come and see the garden that is your own life, the reality of your own life without your judgment, without your fear, without your doubt. If you can come to see that, that it's no place else, then you will have entered the garden. And when you enter the garden, you'll know exactly what to do, how to care for your life and for yourself and for others. And, you know, you become a gardener. And your life becomes, maybe nothing on the surface appears to change, except you can see the beauty in it. I want people listening to this, I hope, and encourage them to open their eyes. Just open your eyes. Okay, open your eyes. Don't evaluate what you see. Don't judge it. Don't hate it. Don't even love it. Just step foot into it and keep going straight on. That's what I want people to take away. The encouragement, the promise, the path, the way.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your time, Karen. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, and I can't believe it's been 4 years. I hope to speak with you again soon.
You can always stay in touch with me.
I will.
And in your particular situation, stay in touch with me. Okay. Everyone can stay in touch with me. I respond to everyone, you know, and I'm going to give them everybody the same advice, the same encouragement, the same instructions, because it, as I mentioned in the book, you know, what I have to say is plain, and the paradise itself is plain, and it's visible. So I'll just keep pointing you back to what's right in front of you.
Thank you. And I will post your website address on my website, spiritualshow.com. So we'll definitely stay in touch, Karen. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Marie.
Have a wonderful day.
Okay. Take good care.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye. Again, that was Karen Mazin Miller, and you can find the link to her website on mine, spiritualshow.com. Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden, a beautiful book. You are going to enjoy it. I'm sure. I really have been enjoying it. So again, thank you to Karen Mazin Miller. Coming up in just a moment here on Parts on Sync. Here on CITR is Parts Unknown, coming up in just a moment. We'll be back next week with more synchronicity. Be well. Love you so much. Namaste.
Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu. Sukhino Bhavantu. Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu.